When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Hello, everyone. Well, you're now going to hear my first ever live Tea with Twiggy, which I did at the podcast festival with my friend Ben Elton. And we're very excited because we're talking about the play that he's written and directed about my life called Close Up, and many other things about his amazing work. And we did it in front of an audience, which was a first for me, but very enjoyable, and the audience were lovely. So I hope you enjoy it.
Hiya.
Goodness.
Oh. Hello.
Hello.
I'm Twiggy and that's Ben.
I'm Ben.
Muddled up. This is so weird because I've been doing my Tea with Twiggy podcast for about 3 years, and you very sweetly did one with me, didn't you?
I did indeed.
But
this is my
usually
second.
Usually I do it at home online and I'm in my tracksuit bottoms and my slippers and I put a nice top on whoever I'm
talking to. Because we're on Zoom.
Because we're on Zoom.
Well, you're a wonderful engineer. You've met for the first time today.
I know.
Having done so many. Your producer.
My producer,
yeah, absolutely.
Cody is at the back there somewhere.
He's there somewhere.
And we've never met because when we started the podcast, it was COVID. Yeah. And so I only know when I got out the car tonight, I said to him, I need a screen round your face because that's the only way I'm used to looking at him. But anyway, thank you for joining me, Ben.
Very much my pleasure.
I'm so thrilled it's you I'm talking to. And I want to know, because Ben has just starred himself in a show that he wrote and directed, and it's been a smash hit every time it's done. We Will Rock You, the Queen musical. And this time you starred in it.
I did indeed, alongside Brenda Edwards and Lee Mead. We had quite a starry cast. And of course, the wonderful Galileo and Scaramouche, played by Ian McIntosh, and our very own Eleanor Skye.
Eleanor Skye.
Who's going to be playing you. In a new musical. We'll get on to that later.
But
we Will Rock You.
I want to know, because you said to me it's my first time in the West End.
Well, it's not just
in
my,
a show.
Not
acting.
Just my first time in the West End. It's my first professional acting, singing of any sort. I'm 64.
Really?
And not only was it my West End debut, when we had the first warm-up on the stage at the Coliseum, which was where We Will Rock You was on.
It's a nice little theatre.
A very venerable building, nearly 3,000 seats. They had a big, we must have the photo for the West End newbies. And I was in the middle of it with all these sort of young 20, 22-year-olds who were doing their first West End. It was about like half a dozen who'd never been in the West End before. And that included me, but not just the West End. I'd never delivered lines professionally. I mean, obviously they're my own lines, but I was still acting. The last time I acted was as a boy. And the last time I was in a musical was as a boy. I gave my Artful Dodger twice.
I was going to say, you're quite famous for your Artful Dodger.
Well, I'm famous in a very small pool. The Surrey Advertiser were kind enough to say I showed great promise for the future. And it was the last good review I got for about 30 years, actually. But no, I loved musical theatre as a teenager. Like you. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I've been in musical theatre professionally a lot. and often been asked by gay men, oh my God, Ben, how are you not gay? Because I love musical theatre so much. That's something that's often been asked. It's less so now because it's, you know, the whole everything gender-wise is getting blurred now. But there was a time when there was this idea that straight blokes didn't like musicals. And I absolutely love it. And Paul McCartney absolutely loves it. He used to fight John Lennon about it because John Lennon thought it was a granny art form, you know, and it's not. It's a great art form, and I've always loved it. And, you know, kids, my mates would all be into football. And I, even now, you know, if you offered me, you know, tickets to the World Cup final with England in it or a good production of Oliver, I'd go to Oliver. I mean, I'm really not interested in sport.
I'm with you. You know,
I'd go and see a good musical over a good sports game anytime.
So when you were playing in We Will Rock You, because you wrote it, did you stick to the author's lines or did you improvise?
Well, it was funny. I was a very bad example. I mean, it's a good question because, of course, I never let... a tiny amount of improvisation allowed. But honestly, most times when actors start kind of thinking they're funny, they found it, that's when they lose it. And you have to be very careful about that. And actors aren't always the best judge of whether they're being funny or not. And if they do something funny, sometimes... they keep trying to do that again, and it was only a moment. So that time I just coughed it just got that laugh. So every night they try the cough again. Of course, it'll never be funny again because it was only an improvisatory moment. And so I'm pretty firm about not, you know, people don't take the piss out of my script. But then of course I get on stage and I do. And I'm doing a little bit of extemporizing. So it was a very different, but then I do that. When I'm directing it, I throw in new lines and show, you know, I work with the actors and find where their funny bones are. And so We Will Rock You morphs, it changes. And, you know, most musicals are set in stone. Once the West End or Broadway production has been done, there's a Bible that's called The Bible, which is a production notes where every Christine holds the rose to the Phantom exactly the same way as, you know, Michael Crawford, I've forgotten her name now, Andrew's second wife, what was her name?
Oh, Sarah Brightman.
Sarah Brightman, I shouldn't have forgotten that, my goodness, sorry, Sarah. But anyway, so, you know, and if you go and see Hamilton anywhere in the world, they are doing exactly the same. And of course, with a show that complex, you have to. But We Will Rock You isn't like that. It changes every time because I'm always working on it, Brian and Roger also. It's more contemporary jokes and I will work with the actors and you'll find what they can do because it's the same with singing the songs. No one can sing, you know, Somebody to Love like Freddie did, but we have a woman, Scaramouche sings it. No one can sing We Will Rock You like Freddie did, but we have Galileo singing and we always encourage them to find their own rock bones. That's what Brian and Roger do. And I always encourage my actors to find their own funny bones and I work with them. But it becomes a problem because then I go away, the cover goes on and the cover is doing whatever I've given to the, but they have different funny, but it's very, actually, I wish I'd written a Bible and just kept it the same,
you know,
22 years ago.
Theatre is a living thing.
It's a living thing.
It changes.
And when I'm on stage
every night
as Pop, which is the character I played in We Will Rock You, which is a sort of venerable old hippie guru, it's a kind of, he has the same sort of silly role in the play as Doc in Back to the Future. He's kind of the old fool who actually kind of knows things, but he doesn't really have a very, very clear way of expressing himself. I did improvise a bit, and it was kind of frowned upon a bit, not by the cast, they loved it, but by the associate director, and because it's not theatre rules. And when you've got a lot of machinery moving around on stage, and we're all so conscious of health and safety now, as we should be, but, you know, it does kill things a bit when they say, look, if you change the content of the line, people won't necessarily know where they start. I say, oh, come on, look, they're not stupid. They know I'll end at the right place. I just might have a meander in the middle. So, yeah, I was a little bit naughty, but I was the director, and yeah.
You could get away with it. I did a production in Chichester of Bly Spirit. I played Elvira, the ghost.
The master, Noel.
We had a wonderful actress. I mean, she was lovely. She's not with us anymore.
Dead or just gone to Clacton?
No, she's not. She's up in the sky.
Right, okay.
I won't like Clacton say her name, sometimes. She was lovely and everything, but she would jump pages.
Oh, no, that's...
I mean pages.
If Noel Coward, he would have been spinning in his grave, let me tell you.
But she... it didn't affect me because I was playing the ghost, and the only person who talks to the ghost is
Jennifer
the husband.
Played that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But Madame Arcati and Charles, the husband,
big scenes. Wrong.
And the actor playing Charles was such a nervous wreck at the end of the he lost a stone and a half in weight because she kept
Was she on the way?
Yeah,
you see, you can't play when you're demented. It's just not, you've got to be.
And she would
I mean, it's but inclusive, but it's no good for the author.
She'd not only jump, she'd then go back. So
the production is still going on somewhere, I believe. There's a Noel Coward. One of my favourite Noel Coward stories. I'm a huge Noel Coward fan.
Oh, me too.
He's, you know, one of the great, great comedians of English letters and brilliant songwriter as well. And when I'm talk to actors about, you know, extraneous syllables, you know, they'll put I means in, I mean at the beginning of a sentence or, you know, or whatever. And I'll say, no, it's messing with the rhythm of the gag. And they, And I tell us an old coward story where he was directing Dame Edith Evans in the National Theatre revival of Hay Fever, which was his first big comedy success in 1924. Very funny play, and there's a line in it where there was always a grand dame in an old cow play, like Madame Arcati. Yeah. And there's a line where the sort of posh lady says, on a clear day, you can see Marlowe. Now, in order to know his joke, Marlowe's a town. He's also a Renaissance playwright. And there were two other Renaissance playwrights called Beaumont and Fletcher. You just need to know that in order to get the joke. I mean, it's a long-winded way to get there. So anyway, she goes to the window and Dame Edith Evans would always say, on a very clear day, you can see Marlowe. And one day, Noel Coward said, darling, the line is on a clear day, you can see Marlowe. On a very clear day, you can see Marlowe and Beaumont and Fletcher. And that was. And in those days, they knew their Renaissance playwrights, so it brought the rehearsal to a...
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. Anyway,
I don't know why.
Cracking Noel Coward anecdotes. Goodness gracious.
Yeah, I actually did meet him.
Hmm?
I was...
Well, he would have sought you out. I mean, he loved style and class.
I met him on holiday in Jamaica.
Oh, you just bumped into
him? Yeah. Well, I was staying with friends. I was like 18 years old. I knew who he was. I was very nervous
because I'd
been warned that he had quite an acidic tongue.
A brittle.
But he was so gorgeous and so lovely.
He would have loved you.
And we got on a treat.
Mm.
And then he came back to England and the lovely Robert Stevens, the actor who was a great friend of his, rang me and said, you know, Noel's in hospital and, you know, he's very sick.
After Clacton, he was nearly there, yes. Oh, dying, sorry.
Yeah, he was.
referring to an earlier joke.
And Robert said to me, every day I take him a surprise gift. Will you be the gift tomorrow?
Oh, my God.
So I went to see him in hospital.
Oh, bloody hell.
And it was hysterical because, as you know, in hospital you can't smoke, but he was a big chain smoker.
Yeah.
And they kind of looked the other way, and he had a big carton of cigarettes by his bed, and as he kind of smoked one, he lit the other one, you know.
But killed him, of course, at 73,
of course he
very
did,
young.
Yeah.
Very
he had
young.
Emphysema. But I'm very, very happy I met him.
Yeah, God, I'd have loved to have met Noel Coward. Even dying in bed with a fag on, but yeah.
So, playing the Artful Dodger, how old were you?
Well, we say I gave my Artful Dodger. I gave it twice. I gave my Dodger twice. Once a school production, Godalming Grammar School, and it was very, very memorable for me. It was only three nights in the school hall, but I think I was very good.
I bet you were a great Dodger, actually.
Well, I was a very lovesick Dodger because I was in love with Oliver. And I will say no reason why I should say this, but Oliver was played by a girl.
Good.
And because very few boys wanted to do that sort of thing, so it was quite hard to find a boy to play Oliver. So we had a lovely girl. She was 11 and I was 12, and she was absolutely, I fell utterly in love with her. And she was Gabrielle Glaister, who eventually became Bob in Blackadder.
Oh, how funny.
And you can see, you wonder why I fell in love with her. How pretty is Gabby? And, you know, she's had a wonderful career. She's still a very good friend of mine. I saw her only weeks ago. And, yeah, we were at the same school and I got nowhere, I've got to say. I never did. She went out, as the pretty girls did, she went out with a footballer. And she liked me, but she never let me near her.
Oh,
so that was that. Or ever.
But was that
That was the school one. And then there was the Godalming Theatre Group, and it was, oh my God, it felt like stardom. They came to see me at school because the music teacher who was doing the Oliver at school was also the MD of the local theatre group, the Godalming Theatre Group, of which I am now president and have been for many years.
Oh.
And he said, I think I've got a dodger for our production. And this was like the big time. It was Godalming Borough Hall, but it was 10 nights. Amateur theatre production, 10 nights. Couldn't believe it. I don't think I've ever been as excited again, you know, to be cast. It felt like the West End. It really did. Funny thing about that, any show you're doing is the centre of your life. My daughter was, you know, involved in Cambridge Footlights recently. She had a lovely, wonderful time. And, oh, my God, the passions and everything. And I said, oh, it's true, you know, I put on a lot of plays at university. I wrote continually. I mean, like, play. And every one was as important, frankly, as important as our show that we're doing right now.
You can't,
heart and soul. And those productions of Oliver are some of the happiest memories of my life, apart from literally being like sick with lust and love. which for a 12-year-old are unfamiliar emotions.
Was it doing that role that kind of set the seed that you want to perform, you want to write?
My epiphany was actually in Onslow Village, which is in Guildford. We moved to Guildford in 1968. I was born in Catford, but my father, who is a refugee, I have refugees, I'm very... very proud of the fact my father came here as a terrified 15-year-old boy with no English on, you know, escaping from the Nazis. But he eventually became a physicist, and he was head of physics at Battersea College of Technology, which during, a little bit of social history, during Harold Wilson's expansion. I know you're not necessarily with me on politics, but most of the good things that happened last century were under Labour governments. And in fact, all of them, frankly. So he expanded the universities where they had what they called the yellow brick expansion, the 70s universities, and Surrey University. Battersea College of Technology became Surrey University. And my dad became Professor of Physics at Surrey. And we moved out of Catford and ended up in Guildford, where I joined the Curtain Raisers, which was the local amateur drama society, because they put up a sign at my primary school, I was nine, for a production of Peter Pan. And I went and auditioned. I tried for John, didn't get it. I got Slightly Soiled, one of the lost boys. He's called Slightly Soiled, that's it. And he had a couple of lines, and it was a Road to Damascus experience. The moment I was on a stage playing Slightly Soiled, and I was almost ensemble. I mean, I had two lines. It wasn't a role, but I didn't care. It was just everything to me, everything. I was completely stage struck. And I thought I wanted to be an actor for two or three years. I thought it was acting. But by the time I was 12, partly because Noel Coward had his 70th birthday in 1971, and there was a lot of stuff on the BBC about him. In those days, they kind of were more, they took an interest in playwrights, I suppose. And I just thought, well, imagine writing witty things and writing songs. And I just, it wasn't just Noel Coward. I became a huge P.G. Woodhouse fan as well. And I just thought, I'd rather write comedy than perform comedy. And from that moment on, I didn't do much acting at all. I mean, I did a bit.
Because you went to Manchester University,
I left home when I was...
But you did... I did drama, but
I did theatre studies first. I left home when I was 16 because I didn't want to stay and do my O-levels. I was determined to leave school because I thought, I'm going to make it in theatre. And I had these... There were still sort of local theatres in those days. They'd almost gone. Now, almost Rep. I don't know if knows what Rep was, but local town theatres had what were called repertory companies. And they would literally be the entertainment because, for the locals, you know, telly was in its infancy. And they put on a play a week.
I know.
I mean, people had learned the plays.
But it was... Brilliant training for young actors, wasn't it?
It's all gone now. But I thought, I'll go and sweep the floor at a Rep Theatre and they'll give me a starring role or let me write plays for them. And my parents were very anxious that I stayed in education. And so I left home. There was this theatre, there was this tech college. It's a tech. Mm-hmm. But there was a visionary educationalist there, a bloke called Gordon Valens, who I've been able to sort of honour in various ways, who'd come up with the idea that theatre is part of education, theatre should be taught, it should be a... You know, the arts, the performing arts are useful to kids. It's a useful thing for young people. Whatever level of talent you've got, expressing yourself, learning to express yourself is a useful thing. And he did it. He had did an A-level called for theatre studies. So I left home. I lived in a caravan at 16. I was living in a caravan on a farm. One cold tap and 200-acre toilet out the back and a spade. and writing my plays, and I did my A-levels there. It's funny because there was a tiny little drama group and we were all like cool and like, well, we thought we were sort of hippies, and then there was this big technical, was mainly catering. So they'd all come to the refectory in their check trousers and their big tall hats, and we'd come in our leotards and all that. And they thought we were weirdos, and we thought they were weirdos. It was kind of like, yeah.
Wasn't we were it all there weirdos. That you met Rick Mayall and...
No, that was when I went to Manchester University to study drama.
Oh, as okay.
Because I knew I wanted to write. I have no interest really in performing. I enjoyed playing pop.
Really?
But it's no surprise that it took me literally my entire professional career to take an acting role, and then it was just one of mine for a laugh. because I only became a stand-up comedian as a means of making a living. You know, it was 1981, I was 21, I was on the dole, I'd just left university. There was a thing called alternative comedy. It was a boom, and like suddenly stand-up comedy was kind of cool. The sort of legacy of Lenny Bruce, the great American comedian, Woody Allen, I know we won't get onto him, but those more cerebral comedians, more of an American tradition, whereas the British stand-up tradition was very much gag-telling, which was great, but it was very much telling jokes, mother-in-law, etc., which is, you know, it can be a very great art form, but not always. But there was this new idea of comedy as a medium for ideas, which really attracted me. And I also was getting nowhere. I'd written a play about Mussolini and sending it to, I don't know why it was about Mussolini, but it was. Always been interested in history. And I'd sent it to every rep company and, of course, got a rejection letter back. So it was almost necessity that turned me to stand-up comedy. It was that or get a non-theatre job. One thing alternative comedy was booming. Rick Mayall and Ed Edmondson, with whom I made The Young Ones, were already in it. A club called the Comic Strip.
Oh, okay.
It was a club called the Comedy Store. Very nasty club, really tough place to gig. But yeah, I wrote myself an act just as a means of earning a tenner and getting my material out there. I became my own advert, you know.
And so how did the idea of The Young... Was it your idea or was
no,
it
No, it was
there,
Rick's idea. It so The Rick's Young Ones, I mean, I can't see you. I don't know what age anyone is or what your experiences are. You're probably all Twiggy fans, but there was a sitcom...
I doubt it.
There was a sitcom right at the beginning of the 80s called The Young Ones,
it
which
was
considered a sort of a bit of a game changer in that it was a bit anarchic and a bit mad. But most importantly, it was very much centred on youth figures. Most sitcoms used to be about middle-aged people, whether they were working-class people like Steptoe and Son or Alf Garnett, or whether they were middle-class people like The Good Life. Mm-hmm. It was middle-aged people.
Yeah.
And there had been sitcoms with young people in it. I'm not saying there hadn't, you know, Man About House, things like that, but there were less. And we did that, a thing called The Young Ones. And that came about because Rick Mayall, a visionary genius of comedy, who's died far too young in his early 50s, I met him at university, and him and Aid, another great, great, great comic artist, had already formed a double act, and they were 2 years above me. So I was very much farty. I was the fresher. But Rick particularly took to me. He liked my writing, and we became very good friends. And they left, and I did another 2 years at university and kept writing my plays. And then I came to London, and they'd already gone to London, and they were trying to scratch a living on this alternative comedy circuit. And there was a little bit of groove happening. Think, you know, there was a few of them, Rick particularly, were getting a little bit of press interest. And the BBC, a guy called Paul Jackson, a producer, came to the Comedy Store, the Comic Strip, and saw Rick and Aid and said, I'd love to try and pitch something to the BBC with you. And Rick came up with the idea for the young ones. But I then wrote the pilot. I remember it was the most amazing, game-changing night of my life, really, in that Rick rang up and said, come to the pub, I've got a great idea. And he was there with his girlfriend, who Lisa Mayer, who also co-wrote the Young Ones. And I went down, and he said, I want to do a sitcom based on the characters I do and Aid does at the club. And there was a couple of others, Nigel Planer and Pete Richardson. And he said, these four characters, always men then. I mean, now we wouldn't dream of doing a sitcom where there was basically only men. But in those days, it didn't seem strange at all, which is, you know, it's good things have changed. I mean, well, you wouldn't dream of it. You'd say, well, where are the women's parts? You know, where are the diverse parts? But in those days, poor white guys, that was what we did. And he pitched the idea to me, and I was so excited, I went home that night and wrote the whole pilot.
Wow.
Yeah, I did. I wrote our 28-minute sitcom all night.
You did.
And it's exactly what is on the screen.
Wow.
Honestly, it scarcely changed at all. I did an interview with Rick before he died, where I showed him the handwritten transcript, and it's and we read it, and it's what's
that's
it's
amazing.
What's on the telly, yeah. But Rick,
so that must have changed your life because it was so huge.
It was going, but it took a while. So Witness, never, ever, ever, you know, the don't count your money while you're sitting at the table. Don't count your money until you've got it. So we pitched this, and we got a pilot commission. Amazingly, I mean, the BBC was pretty wild in those days that they would because it was a strange script. And, oh, it's unbelievably exciting. Like, the BBC, I was 21 years old, and they commissioned me to write a pilot episode, right? So that commission happened in about February 81, right? Mm-hmm. We eventually made that pilot a year later, just the pilot, and then they commissioned the series. So that was fast, but it's still quite slow if you're 21 and eager.
Yeah.
Well, when they commissioned it, February 81, I was living just near Hampstead in a flat that my parents had inherited from his dad, because the German government was very good to Jews that survived. They gave them it sounds funny, doesn't it, really? But yeah, the German government became a very liberal and a very decent government, and one of the things they did do was attempt some kind of making amends. So my grandfather had quite a decent pension, and so they had a flat in Hampstead, which I was living in. So very lucky, privilege of being middle class. Yeah. I was in the right place, the wrong time, the right time. I'm not, you know, the fact that I was able to live in London rent-free for a couple of years while we were doing the Young Ones, life-changing. That's a privilege that most, it's what our musical's about.
I know.
It's exactly about that. It's about, you know, how working class people, their own, anyway, we won't get into that until we do.
We might be here all night.
You've only asked one question.
No, we're halfway.
I'll just finish this. So we got commissioned, and there was a butcher on my way from the tube station, Hampstead tube station, where the flat was. I'd pass this butcher, and I'd always go and buy a sausage, and I really wanted to buy one of those steaks that looked so good, and I could never afford it. Never did. Anyway, we got commissioned. I went back, and I went past the usual sausages. And I said, no, I'm going to have, I had a girlfriend, we were living, and I said, we're going to have two steaks. Oh, I'm celebrating. I couldn't resist it. I said, I've just been commissioned by the BBC, right, a sitcom. They were quite impressed. Oh, well done, you, et cetera, steak, there you go. Marvellous. Of course, it took a year. So for like 3 months, I'd go in for my sausage. Oh, here's the TV star. When are we going to see it? I've been looking in my radio times, man. I haven't seen anything. And literally, the months went on. Eventually, I couldn't go in there anymore because they took the piss so much. Because, you know, it took a year. So it like, where was that? You know, I looked like a total fantasist, you know. Anyway, I got the last laugh, but I never went back.
You certainly did.
I never went back and hit him with my four BAFTAs.
Did it get four BAFTAs?
No, not the Young Ones got one, but I've won four.
I know you have.
Thank you.
You've got so many.
That wasn't the only
awards.
Thing I did. A couple of Olivias. I'm just saying.
And
just
an
saying.
Emmy.
Yeah, I got an Emmy. Lifetime Golden Rose. No, I'm just saying. Golden Dagger, Crime Writer of the Year. I'm the only stand-up comedian who's ever won the Crime Writer of the Year award. That's for sure. It's a beautiful award.
Is it a
dagger in a velvet case. It's like a paper opener, but it, you know, well, who opens envelopes anymore? But you could stab someone with it.
I've written
16 novels.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you ever sleep?
People say this. I don't actually. I'm not a workaholic. People think, oh, you must work all the time. I don't at all. I've got friends in tonight and they'll testify. We know how to, you know, get on a pub and have a nice time. And
good.
I don't work all the time, but if you do work and if you actually do some work, you can get quite a lot done.
Yeah.
And I think artists are quite indulged. You'll often, not so much anymore because everyone's so desperate. You know, it's so hard to, what we now say, monetize. It's so hard to get paid for anything.
Yeah.
But in the old days, you'd see, oh, I can't, I have a gîte in France, and unless I'm there, I really can't write. I have to, you know, the Hebrides for me. And you think, no, if you're a writer, you could write, like I wrote the first episode of The Young Ones in a freezing cold toilet in our flat. Because Kate was having a dinner party. That was my girlfriend, and she was a lawyer, and she was a pupil, and she had her head of chambers around. So I was writing The Young Ones pilot in the loo, and we didn't have heating, and it was very cold. All I'm saying is, if you actually write when you're sitting down, you can get quite a lot written, and I have lots of time off. Lots of holidays.
Write straight into the computer, or do you handwrite?
The first series of The Young Ones and the first series of The Blackadder were handwritten. Richard was typing, I was handwriting, that's Blackadder. Mm-hmm. And so we have real artifact. We have the genuine script.
Ah, so have you still got
them? Yeah. Wow. With, and it's amazing. I mean, the old, what used to be cut and paste used to be Pritt, scissors, and you'd literally, you'd stick something on, turn here, staple, see appendix B, and that was your, you know, that was literally, the scripts are just covered in you know, bits of glue and bits of...
Brilliant. Have you got them?
I've got those scripts. And then I learned to type, and it was one of the best things I ever did. I mean, honestly, learning to do proper typing, I mean, I sort of can, you know, copy typing when you literally don't.
Yeah.
I don't look at the keyboard. If you look at a keyboard, you'll never learn to type. I couldn't draw you a keyboard now. I couldn't tell you where QWERTY is, but I could type QWERTY. Really, it's funny how the brain works.
How peculiar. I can't type.
I had this finger chart with, you know, this is, and I just did that. And within a few days, I can type really fast. And it was so important to me. And I went through, first I had an old typewriter, and then I had a Olivetti, where you could remember the little the electronic typewriters, which was a tiny technological blip just before word processing, where you get these little reels of gluey tape, and you could lift the letters back off the page with. I mean, that was electric. It had a memory, and if you put backspace correct, it would the glue instead of using the ribbon, it would use this glue, and it would lift the letters, but anyway, it's boring to say, but it was a brief period of technology. And then I started, Stephen Fry introduced me to word processing in 1985. He was, as you know, he's an evangelist for, you know, computing and all that shit. And he showed me his Apple Mac, and I couldn't believe it. And I started using word processing, and it's an incredible tool. It's the only thing I use. I'm no good on computers. I still can't, you know, download apps and things, but I love word processing because all that cutting and pasting, of course, you just cut and paste.
Just do it.
So yeah, I type everything.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Did you meet? You didn't meet Richard at uni.
No, Richard.
How did you meet Richard?
I mean, the funny thing is, we're talking about, you know, you're a working class woman, and it's partly what our play is about, how there was genuine social mobility in the 60s. I'm middle class, in as much as my parents were teachers or whatever, but I was red brick. And then there was another class. Remember the class? Anybody old enough to remember TW3? That was the week that was.
Yeah.
The satire program. Well, there was a program about, there was a sketch about class in the 60s, which we include in our show, where John Cleese, Ronnie Barker, and Ronnie Corbett are revealed. And John Cleese has got a bowler hat on, and Ronnie Barker's got a little trilby, and Ronnie Corbett's got a flat cap. And it was the class sketch. And Cleese says, I'm upper class, so I look down on them. And then Barker says, I'm middle class, so I look up to him and down on him. And then Ronnie Corbett said, I know my place. And that was the sketch. It's a very, very famous sketch from the 1960s, which, as I say, we feature in our show. So we went to Manchester, which was kind of not posh, but Richard was part of the Uxbridge gang.
Okay.
And in those days, that was a huge comic resource. The Pythons were all Uxbridge, mm-hmm. you know, and the original satirists, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, and Alan Bennett, you know.
Yeah.
They were all Uxbridge, Oxford and Cambridge, all men. Well, there was a few women. I mean, there was Eleanor Bron, and yeah, anyway.
Whatever. Oh, yeah.
So Richard knew Rowan. Rowan actually did a degree in engineering. Not a lot of people know this at Newcastle.
Wow.
But then he went and did a master's in engineering at Oxford, where Richard was doing English, I presume. And they had what was called smokers, where everyone would go to a little room in a common room, and everyone would smoke and drink wine, and they'd get up and do little sets. And that's where Richard met Rowan, because Rowan got up and did a silent dumb show. He was this slightly older engineering student who is so non-showbiz, it's not you know, I mean, Rowan is a deeply private person, and not he won't, you know, he's not interested in that side of it. But he has this sublime comic gift. I mean,
I'll say his comic talent is amazing.
And what he was doing then was without a script, but he was just being funny. He just got up and was funny. The face is just funny. It's an extraordinary thing. Anyway, so that's how Richard and Rowan met, and Richard started working with Rowan, and they did their stuff, and eventually they did a thing called Blackadder 1, which was the Blackadder, which I wasn't involved in. And in the meantime, the Young Ones had come through and been a great big hit. And Richard sought me out. And the reason he sought me out, we hadn't met, was he loved the Young Ones, and he wanted to do a sitcom with Madness. Does anyone here remember the pop group Madness?
Yeah,
right. I do. They are wonderful. The Nutty Boys, they're lovely, lovely, lovely people. And it would have been fantastic. They could all act. They were great. Genuine Camden geezers, fantastic people. And Richard, who is, as you know, is not stupid, had this idea, let's do a Monkees, let's do a London Monkees.
Oh yeah, brilliant.
We'll do a madcap sitcom using this wonderful group of lads who write such fabulous tunes. But it was just at the end of their chart success, the BBC, because it was Richard and me, and we were sort of hot writers. In a way, we were what they wanted rather than Madness. And we shot a one camera pilot for a morning. It was total bollocks. They sort of indulged us, but they didn't indulge us enough to let it work. And it withered on the vine. And I think it's a great shame, because it would have been me and Richard Curtis writing a sitcom for Madness, I think would have been a very good thing. But the upshot was, because it didn't work, Richard said, also what hasn't worked is the first series of The Blackadder, or at least it hasn't worked very well, and we want to rethink it, and why don't you come and write it with me? Richard Curtis and I became the team that created The Blackadder as is known, which is Blackadder 2 to 4, which is a studio sitcom. You see, the first Blackadder is shot on film, no studio audience. It's done on location. And as I said at the time, I said, you know, Rowan falling off a horse at 200 meters is no funnier than anyone else falling off a horse at 200 meters. But you get in there in front of a studio audience and you let that face go and you give him a syllable he's not very good at, like Bob, and it becomes comedy magic, you know. So yeah, that was how The Blackadder came about. Richard and I failed a sitcom for Madness, but we scored a sitcom.
Didn't it become a huge hit worldwide? It wasn't just in the UK.
Blackadder?
Yeah.
Well, it is. I wouldn't say. I mean, it's known abroad.
Oh, they know it in America.
In Australia, they know. No, not much in America. Rowan's fame internationally is Mr. Bean, which I have a very tiny bit of. They didn't really let me in on that, the bastards. I wrote, because they developed Mr. Bean. Rowan and Richard had developed Mr. Bean at university. That was their kind of first thing.
Oh, really?
It's a fantastic sketch. I mean, just mind-numbingly good idea. Richard, maybe it was Rowan's, but I've been fortunate enough to be on the receiving end when Richard, you know, has a great idea, and it happens quite a lot. I remember when we were doing Blackadder 3, Richard came round. We never used to write together, but we'd chat together, and then we'd split up and write separately. And he came round and said, I think I've got a good idea. It's about Johnson's Dictionary. Now, perhaps some of you all know that Dr. Johnson famously wrote the first English dictionary. Well, it wasn't the first, but let's not be pedantic. Richard had this simple, he said, what about Dr. Johnson spends 25 years writing the first English dictionary, lends it to Blackadder, and Baldrick puts it on the fire, and hence Blackadder's got a weekend to write 25 years work. And, you know, right, and it was just such an incredible idea. You know, so that's Richard. Anyway, the first Mr. Bean sketch, for those of you who don't know, was a silent piece where Rowan, I did see it later. I think he did it for some policeman's ball or something. So Rowan's there as Mr. Bean. I don't even know if it was called Mr. Comes on the stage, and he's on one side of the stage, the spotlight's on the other. Has anyone seen this sketch? So he's spotless. So he's like dumb show doing Mr. Bean. And he wants to, you know, he's saying, bring the, you know, and the spotlight won't move. And he's going, I want to act. He's miming, I want to act here, but the light's over there. Anyway, eventually, having been very funny about that for God knows how long, he gets a straw and he goes over to the spotlight, the pool of light, and he sucks it up. so that there's an iris. There's an iris on the camera. So obviously the technical people are shrinking it, and they shrink it as he sat up. And he goes, and he burped it out, and it was just a fantastic. And of course, they put on the spotlight on that side. You can imagine the joke. Simple. You just need two spotlights, and it's just a fantastic joke. So that was Mr. Bean, and it was theirs. And my only contribution to Mr. Bean was I wrote the exam episode, the one where Mr. Bean takes a.
Oh yeah.
Well, say you wrote. I mean, obviously Rowan then takes it and runs with it. Yeah. But you know, they have to be written. You know, he gets out a gonk, he gets out another gonk. You know, it's a job. So I wrote that, but no, I'm not a part of the Mr. Bean action. And frankly, that's the worldwide smash. That's where you get your Lamborghinis. That's where. Yeah, you don't get them from Blackadder. Blackadder is iconic in the UK and known around the world. But
yeah,
it's
I think
not,
it is known nah. more than you think, actually.
Look, I know. I see what we get. Mate.
Oh, okay.
She thinks she knows more about Black. Do I talk to you about Vogue?
Who knew? Who knew? I want to talk to you because it's one of my favourite films that you wrote and Kenneth Branagh directed, I think.
Well,
All Is True.
All Is
and
True.
And he starred in it.
He did indeed, along with Dame Judy.
And I don't know whether you've seen this film, but if you haven't, can you still get it anywhere?
Everything's available. This is a film, it's quite a serious film. It's so lovely.
It's a beautiful film, actually. I loved it.
It was a labour of love. It's a film about Shakespeare in retirement. Mm-hmm. And above all, it's not a comedy. It's the only sort of, well, we should perhaps use the term major piece of work, if I can say that, I've ever done, which has been very specifically without laughs. Although there are laughs in it. I mean, there's humour in it. I've written novels which aren't really comedies. I wrote one sort of about the Holocaust, you know, not a lot of laughs there. Yeah. But it's about Shakespeare in retirement. Judi Dench played Anne Hathaway, who was a few years older than Shakespeare. Not as much older as Judy is, but she's a genius actress, so she can play anyone. She could play Twiggy and she'd be great. You know, I mean, she could do anything.
Yeah.
And Ken plays Shakespeare. And Cillian McKellen plays the Earl of Southampton.
Not a bad little cast.
No, not a bad cast. Considering I wrote the script, that was amazing. So Ken wanted to do a serious film about Shakespeare in retirement. It was a lovely thing. I was on an island called Rottnest Island, which is in Western Australia, where my wife comes from. And I live half my life over there. And funny thing is, we were locked in because there were storms. And most people, everyone's told, you've got to get off the island now and go home on the ferries, or else there'd be 3 days, there'd be no ferries. So most people had to leave because they had, you know, jobs and babies, etc. It's a holiday island, a little Rottnest Island. It's just off Perth in Western Australia, off Fremantle. But we didn't have to go back. Our kids grown up, and we thought, great, we'll stay. We'll stay for the storm. And we were the only people on the island. This shop was still open.
You know, wasn't it scary?
Get the beer. Oh, it was unbelievable. I mean, it was a serious storm. And it was, you know, the place was empty and we had it. And it was at that point that Ken Branagh rang me up on obviously a difficult signal and said, I want you to write a play about Shakespeare in retirement. I don't want you to be funny. I deliberately don't want you to pursue any jokes. I want you to consider what it's like to spend your entire life devoted to your creative muse, your talent, and realize at the end of it that you have messed up your private life, that you've neglected the things that matter. Of course, Shakespeare lost his son, Hamlet. Many people have written fiction about this. I have. There's a play currently on at the RSC called Hamlet. The last episode of a sitcom I wrote called Upstart Crow is about the death of Hamlet.
Another brilliant.
Well, that's a comedy, but a labour of love starring David Mitchell. Anyway, he said it was a real challenge. He said, write about a life full of success, which has essentially been wasted in that the self-knowledge that he was able to imbue in his scripts, give everyone else such knowledge, he didn't seem to be able to learn from himself. And it was an amazing, and in the storms, you know, it was a King Lear, because Shakespeare's last plays are really interesting. They feature fathers without sons, but with strong daughters. It's interesting that you start with a Tempest, and you look at A Winter's Tale, and you look at King Lear, They're all fathers with strong daughters, the father-daughter relationships. And that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And not often pointed out by critics, I have to say. I was quite surprised to find out little people had noticed what I noticed, which is, well, that's interesting, because, of course, Shakespeare had two grown-up daughters, both of whom were serious characters, quite very interesting in their own right. So that's got to, there's got to be something interesting there. But he didn't write about wives. None of these, you know, Prospero, Lear, can't remember the bloke in Winter's Tale because I've had half a can of Hells. But he doesn't talk about wives. He talks about daughters. That's interesting too. Where was Anne in his world view, in his personal view? She survived him. She was older than him, but she survived him. So anyway, this was the challenge that Ken gave me, and it was a beautiful one, and it ended up being, I think, a very, very
beautiful
film.
It's a really good film, yeah. I think.
Well, that's kind. And those who saw it have
beautifully shot. It's beautifully written.
Well, thank you. And I got a chance to write. And Judy Dench sent a little video from the set saying, your script is the reason I'm doing this movie. It's not Ken. She said, it's your script that brought me, which was pretty incredible. Yeah. She's an upstart Crow fan. Giles Brandreth and her did a whole scene of it in her back garden. Yeah.
Oh, how
brilliant. Giles taped it and, yeah,
but
showed it
to me. But it's so clever, upstart Crow. You are.
Well, that's nice to hear.
I'm not going to flatter you too much, but you are clever.
Well, that's very kind of you, Twigs.
And if you haven't seen Upstart Crow, it's absolutely brilliant. I'm sure you can still get that online, can't you?
I don't know. You get that thing, you see, like, there's an article in the garden about a new thing and it's on Paramount Plus Disney's X. And have I got that? I don't know. I just presume I haven't got the, I don't know, I don't see anything anymore because I don't know where anything is. I mean, you know, why does the BBC take things off iPlayer?
Don't ask me.
Why do they take it off? It's mean.
I know.
I mean, what's the point of that?
No, you're right, because there's a couple of things I went back recently to try and get again.
And they've gone.
Or they've taken off series one and left series two and three, which doesn't make sense because if you haven't seen series one...
Well, there you go.
You don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you, because obviously stand-up has been a big part of your career. When you first started, you were quite outrageous in your views and what you said. And
I don't think that's quite the case, but, you know,
when you went,
matter of opinion.
When you went back to it, what was in 2019, you did...
Yes, I did.
Because of all the political correctness, did that affect... what you wrote and what you said, or didn't care?
I've always cared deeply.
No, and but I've, I mean, I've didn't care been, about behaving.
I've always been politically correct, you see. That's the point. Some people think I invented it. Some people blame me for it.
Really?
Because back
Why?
In the early, people think I killed Benny Hill. They literally, no, they do. In his obituaries, they say, well, Benny Hill was driven out of television by the likes of Ben Elton with their politically correct comedy, their refusal to allow honest jokes about big tits and, you know.
Oh, I see.
No, I was, because I, in the 80s, I was very much basing a lot of my material on my personal position as a feminist ally, as somebody who believed I lived in a deeply sexist patriarchal society in which women were diminished and judged by their bodies. There's a bit of that in our play, as you know. And I did a lot of routines about it. I don't say everybody was and I certainly don't say Benny Hill was deliberately in any way attempting to diminish women, but nonetheless, the women in his comedy series, as they were in many series, were decorative and the subjects of jokes. And I wrote quite a lot of comedy about that. And, you know, I was quite, quite notorious at the time because I was also very anti-Thatcher and, you know, I was...
I say quite political as well.
Yeah, political. But in a way, the world's kind of caught up with me a bit. I remember doing a routine in the 80s where I would say, I've always believed in the power of language, and I think you have to mind your language. I think you have to be terribly careful what you mean and be clear. And I used to say, because I talked a lot about sex as a young comedian in his 20s, you know, you're doing routines about, you know, your experience, trying to pull, getting rejected, you know, self-doubt, etc. And I'd always never presume that the audience was necessarily straight. And I'd say, the straight guys in the audience will know what I'm saying, or whatever I'd say, and, you know, if you're straight. And I remember Aid Edmondson going, oh, it's just so pious. Fuck, you know, it doesn't matter. You don't have to say that. People know you're straight. But I always thought it was important not to presume everybody had the same sexuality. And as a comedian, I worked that into my routines. This is in the 80s, because I had another epiphany moment at university when I saw a young woman at the refectory wearing a badge. This is 1977. And her badge said, "How dare you presume I'm heterosexual?" And I thought, wow, that's amazing. That's really interesting.
What year was that?
It's 1977. She was punk. She was cool. You know, she had Rock Against Racism on one side. Oh, okay. I presume she was a lesbian. Maybe she wasn't. But I thought, gosh, you're right. Because actually, probably I would have presumed you were heterosexual. Because we all presumed everybody was. It's, you know, you even thought maybe Larry Grayson's heterosexual. Maybe it's an act. No, it wasn't an act. And, you know, like basically gay people hid in plain sight by doing a pantomime version of being gay or whatever. Because, of course, it was illegal when you were first famous. Yeah. It was still illegal. Yeah. You know, John Gielgud lived under threat, the greatest actor, you know. And I remember that thinking, gosh, she's absolutely right. I would have presumed you were. And that's, I'm not saying we've all got to go around all the time going, you know, what are your pronouns? I know there is a problem that it's all got a little complex, to say the least. But on the whole, I think these developments are healthy, and I was always a part of it. So when I went back on the road, I didn't doubt my ability to express my own moral position comically and honestly. Mm-hmm. And if anybody objected, fuck them. And I've always felt that. And nobody did. And I did 15 minutes on trans and my confusion with trans. I don't pretend remotely to, I'm working through it. I'm thinking about it, as we all are. And the routine took that on board. It talked about the generational changes and how attitudes are changing so quickly. The whole comic basis of the routine was, give us a minute, because this is really big shit. You know, like, you can literally change that. Well, this is something I need to process. I can't just leave, because for young people, it seems obvious. To me, I need to work through it. And that was the basis of the routine. And my daughter said, "You're going to get cancelled, Dad. This is it." And I wasn't, because I think I spoke honestly and with sympathy to all sides, as I've always tried to do, as you know, because we've had dinner many times. Yes.
We have many times.
And you've never taken offence, have you?
You don't.
Oh, I don't know.
No, I don't take offence at all. No, I think you're absolutely brilliant. But didn't you get cancelled because of COVID in yours?
Oh, I got cancelled physically, and like everybody did. It was a cultural catastrophe.
In New Zealand or something,
No, we got going again. Oh, it's a culture. I mean, the catastrophe, I mean, once we accept that it was a health catastrophe and beyond a catastrophe for young people, I mean, I don't want to get controversial, but I think we sacrificed the wrong generation. I fully respected lockdown, but I actually don't think it was the right way. I think basically depriving young people, I deal with that on stage as well.
Yeah.
I say, you know, the idea that we were all in it together and we all went through it together. No, time is a concertina. When you're young, a year is stretched out. It's a lifetime of possibility. When you're my age, it's three trips to aquatic aerobics, basically. That's what a year is, you know. And so basically, you know, me sacrificing a year was fuck all. Somebody of 16, they had to defer their first shag for 18 months on my behalf. And I feel it was totally wrong. I think young people were dealt literally the most poisoned card imaginable. And whilst my wife doesn't like me saying this, she said, look, a lot of, you know, protecting granny was important. And yes, protecting granny was important. We've got frail people in our life. But I think the fallout from what young people went through, months of isolation, months of desocialization, is terrifying. And I dealt with that. I don't know why I got onto that.
But don't you think that the government's just panicked and didn't know what to do?
Yeah, they didn't know what. I wouldn't have wanted to try and manage that crisis. Oh, I mean, nobody knew what to do. And I mean,
but you were in Australia.
It wasn't as bad. Now, I was in Australia. I mean, I could have been over here, but as you know, my life is half Australian. It was interesting because Australia is a very big country, and Australia had the most remarkable schizophrenic experience, because whereas West Australia, where I was, had a very short lockdown, and because it's a very isolated state, it's enormous. It's the size of Western Europe. Yeah, it's absolutely enormous. I mean, it's bigger than France, Britain, Spain, all put together. That's Western Australia. But there's only 3,000 people in it. And what they did, well, they're all in basically one place around Perth. And there's a few drovers up north. And of course, there's the indigenous population. You know, anyway, let's not get on a massive geographical description of Australia. The point was, they were able to close their borders, not just to the world, but to the rest of Australia. So this was immensely divisive, but also extraordinarily effective. So Western Australia, we had our theatres open.
Did you?
Within 2 or 3 months, we had a 4 or 5 week lockdown. And after that, few restrictions and the theatres were open. There was a point, I couldn't believe it. I was able to write to Brian May and Roger Taylor because there was a production of We Will Rock You, an amateur production of We Will Rock You on in Perth during 2022, which was the highest grossing theatre show in the world. It was like a 4-night amateur production of We Will Rock
hysterical.
You. And I wrote to Brian and Roger, we are the biggest show on the planet because we're on an amateur stage in Western Australia.
That's
so they
brilliant.
Locked the border. So we had, but you couldn't get in, you couldn't get out. I didn't see my mum for nearly 2 years. Thank goodness our daughter came home just in time.
I say, didn't she just get on like
she
the
did,
last
just
plane?
Got on a plane. But, yeah. But our boys, they got trapped in Melbourne. And Melbourne
was
had
hit,
the most
yeah.
brutal lockdowns in the Western world.
Right.
I mean, I think they did about 190 nights. I mean, they did 200 nights. It was, I mean, and it came and went. It was like the 3 months. And these were lockdowns. These were police yeah. curfew
oh,
lockdowns.
Really?
Wow. I mean, kids snuck out and probably yeah. did manage to shag each other occasionally, but it's and get a drink. But it was really serious lockdowns, and you know, a lot of virtue signaling cops and journalists trying to find some poor person sunbathing and send them back
oh,
home
yeah.
because they're killing granny. And it was oh look, there's a flasher. We run out of time. We've only done one question. He's flashing his light.
It's
oh dear. I'm sorry, we're banging on. Anyway, so yeah, Australia had a number of experiences, and my boys, they suffered, whereas we
yeah,
were,
I yeah, bet. Yeah. Well, before we kind of wind up, we've got to talk about what you're doing now.
Yeah, well, we've got to say that, because we are doing Close Up, Twiggy the Musical. I am the very, very fortunate...
or not, as the case
oh, no.
may be.
Oh, no, no, it's all very good. Twiggy has done me the great honour of entrusting me with the task of adapting her life story for the stage in a musical. Obviously, she lived through some of the most exciting times of the last century, particularly the 60s, of course. But it's a much bigger story than that. And what interested me, as I think I mentioned earlier, is, I mean, although you're a strong woman and you've always been able to operate on your own terms, but you did live in deeply sexist times. You were a model in a period where there was an absolute apartheid. The men were the photographers, women were the models, you know, and you know, the likes of, we won't mention his name, but you know, the notches on their bloody camera stands. And so there's a lot of things that interest me about patriarchal politics and most importantly of all social mobility. Twiggy's life. Well, when you first said to me, we were having dinner. I know you're waving. I will promise to do this quickly. We were having dinner, and Twiggy was saying, you know, my story. Somebody should adapt it. You know, because it's a Cinderella story, really. And I said, Twiggy, it's not a Cinderella story. You had two sisters, but they adored you, and you went straight to the ball at 17, and you've been there ever since. And then we start, because I'd read Black and White, Twiggy's wonderful biography, and I said, but there's so much in your story about. You know, numerous issues, but at the heart of it is class. At the heart of it is you were fortunate enough to come of age in a decade where working class people were not only fashionable, but were deeply valued. The Beatles opened up everything. And before you knew it, the whole charts, all the actors, it was an egalitarian society. I mean, all the posh boys were pretending
yeah.
to be working
yeah.
class. In
well,
order,
what it, happened to me couldn't have happened no. 5 years earlier.
Not earlier, but I contend it couldn't have happened 15 years later or
oh, yeah.
since.
Yeah, interesting.
And I'm saying that social mobility, which appeared to explode in Britain in the 60s, it looked like everybody had a shot. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think levelling up is not only a grotesquely contorted piece of Orwellian newspeak, fucking levelling up. What the? Anyway, but also I think social mobility has ground to a halt. I think if you're born into the underclass now, your chances of getting out of it are
it's tough.
Is zero, yeah. virtually. I think that there is the wealth at the top has become literally grotesque. I mean, as hedge fund managers and God knows we get richer. I mean, I used to be a lot closer to the top than I am now. I'll tell you that because there's this world of wealth which is beyond anyone's imagination, which is all about the manipulation of money. When we were kids, the only bloke that had his private yacht was a bloke called Onassis. That's he was right. famous because he had a yacht. Can you imagine? It's like being Tsar of Russia. Only the Queen's got a yacht and Onassis. Now, yachts queue up like buses at Cannes. I mean, literally, there's hundreds of super yachts because there's hundreds of Onassises. Yeah. They're not making any contribution to society. They're just destroying the planet. But they've got their super yacht. Anyway. It's a very funny musical. It's a very funny musical. We were lots of fun, but it does talk a little bit about social mobility.
It does. Listen, thank you so much. Well, and before we go, we thought if anyone would like to ask us anything. We?
For Ben, can you just expand on how the world of today is closer to the world of Stark?
Twiggy,
could you tell us a bit about being in the Blues Brothers?
Oh, being in the Blues Brothers.
You do that, Twigs.
Well, I was literally in, they flew me to Chicago. I was there for 3 days, I think. And the first day I didn't get to shoot because, well, we realized they were gonna do a scene with John Belushi and I was gonna follow that on, but he couldn't get out of the caravan that day for various reasons. So well,
because he was wired.
Because
he was wired. I mean, he died of rock and roll. It's very sad.
But we didn't know that then. No. It was like genius act. Comic actor. But anyway, my scenes were actually with Dan Aykroyd.
Oh, great.
And I was the girl in the Jag who he stood up at the...
How cool is Twix? Her peripheral stuff, like cover of a Bowie album, she's in the Blues Brothers, peripheral, you know, the stuff that was just like nice little gig did it, you know. There's so much of that that's not even the central story of Twiggy as one of the great fashion icons and style shapers and shifters of really, well, ever since. I mean, she saved Marks and Spencers, let's be honest, you know. It's true, not many people can say that. I think that she got the Dame Hood for that. Literally.
That's hysterical.
And then the other question for you, Ben, was about Stark.
Well, very briefly, Stark is my first novel, and it was about a world where the super rich were aware that they were destroying the environment and the planet. And but they didn't want to stop because their activities were enriching them so much. So they had a plan to carry on ruining the planet, but from space. And they were Stark was short for Star Ark. And they were basically secretly developing a space program for rich people to blast off into space. And it's been sort of trending a bit over the last 2 or 3 years with Elon Musk and Richard Branson and the bald bloke from Amazon all getting their great big penises and flying up into the sky in their phallics. And one of them's even got balls. I think Bezos, bald Bezos. It's like have you seen it? It really has. I mean, you could not make it up, but
that's hysterical.
I did 35 years ago with Stark, so thank you very much.
No other questions?
We can get to the pub if you haven't. I mean, not everyone. Well, I don't mind. We could.
There's a chap.
I'm going to copy this guy's style and ask a question to both of you about something you've done. Twiggy, I'd love to hear about when you were on The Muppet Show.
When I was on The Muppet
you
Show.
You see, again, The Muppet Show.
And Ben, I've never heard you talk about Filthy Rich and Catflap.
Well, it was a wonderful show. Muppet's much more interesting. Thank you. Yeah, it was great. Filthy Rich and Catflap was, in a way, the sequel to The Young Ones. It starred Rick Mayall, Nigel Planer, and Ade Edmondson, and it was a mad show about 70s comedy, a kind of satire on the sort of whole world of Jimmy Tarbuck and Des O'Connor and all of that. And it was great fun, a bit mad. It wasn't a hit, but it's fondly remembered, and I hope fondly remembered by, it was a moderate hit. We only did one series. Rick was going a bit, Rick and I diverged at that point. That's another part. We remain dear friends, but professionally, our artistic life sort of separated. But that's a podcast for another day, and it won't be for a while.
For me, doing The Muppets, it was just a great thrill because I'd been living in America, and I knew The Muppets from Sesame Street, which was a huge children's program that had what were The Muppets, you know, Kermit and...
Jim Henson puppets, yeah.
And so when I came back to England, and I just knew the Muppets, and my daughter, who's here somewhere, she was a little girl and she used to watch it all the time, so I'd watch it with her, and I thought they were brilliant. And when they set up the first series, a lot of British stars were turning down going on because they didn't know what the Muppets were. And when
just
they were
stupid
told,
puppets, you know.
Oh, they were puppets. Yeah. They wouldn't do it. When they came to me, I was like, oh my God, yeah, I'll do the Muppets. How brilliant.
See, you are a taste definer.
And it was brilliant because I have a lovely scene with Miss Piggy who thinks I'm after Kermit because, you know, she loves Kermit. Mm. And I loved her because she flicked her hair. Mm. I thought she was going to hit me, actually. But it was joyous.
What fun
and
that
I
would have been.
It
doing the Muppets, can you believe it? Brilliant. Oh, my God. And she's mates with Paul McCartney. I mean, come on.
It's got one more question. If that's
oh,
right.
One more. Go on, then.
One more. It's all the blokes, isn't it? It's all the blokes.
Ben. Have you still got your glittery suit?
No, and thereby hangs a very short tale. Annie Lennox took it off me. Now, there you go. From those of you who know your genius British rock and roll, wonderful Scottish artist, Eurythmics, sweet dreams are made of this. I mean, Annie Lennox was an iconic superstar of the 1980s and remains so. And she took my glittery suit. Actually, the first one was nicked in a dressing room in Australia. But I lost my glittery suit, but I met my wife, so that was a good dressing room to be in. Yeah. But the second one, which was the one I wore on Friday Night Live and Saturday Live, I donated. She didn't really want it. She didn't want it to wear. She said, will you give us your glittery suit for a charity auction? And I said, I will, as long as you promise not to tell me what you got, because I have this fear. I've been to charity auctions when it happens. Somebody, Little and Large have donated their underpants. Now, do I hear... 8p, you know, it's like, and I just don't want to be the one who's like, well, we got a fiver for it. So I said, you can have my glittery suit, but I don't
I'm
want
sure
to hear what
it
you
went
got.
For much
yeah, I don't know. Somebody's got that glittery suit and they got it off Annie Lennox, not me.
Anyway, thank you all
thank
for
you
coming.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
And supporting
thank
us.
You very much. Bye bye, everyone.
Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed meeting Ben again, because as you know, I've had him on before on my podcast, but that was our first live podcast in front of an audience, which was a little bit scary, but actually very enjoyable. And it was lovely talking to Ben about, you know, the show that we've done together that he's written and directed about my life. And I hope you enjoyed listening to it too, and come and see the play. It's on at the Chocolate Factory in London. Bye. If this is your first time listening to Tea with Twiggy, please do remember to tell your friends. You can also subscribe for free on your podcast app and listen to all my previous guests. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify. So check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.
Just heard a Stripped Media production.